But this morning I thought I'd like to start with a story. You know, these are icebreakers, these stories, and always good fun. And this is a story that I've told before. Some will know, so some won't know. It's a long time ago that I told it. And this is a story about Nasruddin. And Nasruddin was a Sufi holy man or teacher, a saint, but also a bit of a scallywag, as Ajahn Brahm would say, a bit of a scallywag. Had a good sense of humour, and many things he did, they had a good point, but they were very funny as well. So one day the people in the village that he lived in decided that they would have some fun and ask him to come to the mosque to deliver the sermon. I think it's on the Friday they give the sermon. And this is, you know, quite an honour. But they were thinking they'd get some entertainment out of this as they saw him flounder and probably contradict himself and so forth. And so they invited him, and he came, and he got up to give the talk. And the first thing he said to them was, "Do you know what I'm going to speak to you about?" And they said, "No, no, don't know." And then he was disgusted. He said, "What's the point of me talking to you if you don't know what I'm going to talk about?" And then he got up and he left the mosque. And they were all deflated. Of course, they thought they were going to have a great laugh, you know. And then they thought, well, we can outfox him. Next week we'll invite him again. And so they did. And they had another strategy for the next week. And he came at the appointed time, Friday, to give the sermon on the holy day. And he got up and he said to them the same. He said, "Do you know what I'm going to speak about?" And they said, "Yes, yes, we know what you're going to speak about." And he said, "What's the point? What's the point? I might as well go home." And he did. He got up and went home. So the people thought, again, deflated. They thought this another lost opportunity for a lot of fun and merriment. And so they thought, well, we'll invite him again, and we've got another strategy in mind, which you probably have thought of as well. And so they invited him to come on the Friday, the following Friday, and he came at the appointed time and got up to speak. And, of course, he said, "Do you know what I'm going to speak to you about?" And half the people there said, "No, we don't know what you're going to speak about." And the other half said, "Yes, we know what you're going to speak about." And he said, "Well, the half that knows what I'm going to speak about, please tell the half that doesn't know." And then he got up and left. So they didn't get the best of Nasruddin. But I'm not about to do that. But it does point to some of the ways we can listen to talks. If we have our own opinions, our strong opinions, we can't hear what the other person is saying. And if we have no familiarity with the territory, what the subject is, a discussion is about, then that is very difficult for us as well. So it does point to a deeper meaning. There's probably lots of more meanings you can get out of that as well. So this morning I was actually going to talk about this is going to be an introduction to the Noble Eightfold Path. Do people know about the Noble Eightfold Path? I think most people do. And I may do a series of talks, because I'm here for 3 months, so that's quite a good opportunity. So, but when we contemplate, the Noble Eightfold Path is central to Buddhism. For those who don't know, it's the practice of Buddhism that the Buddha taught, and he said, if we practice this, we can experience the ending of all suffering and all unsatisfactoriness. We can experience the highest happiness. So this is the practice aspect of Buddhism. And it's very interesting. I was reading Bhikkhu Bodhi last night, and he said, if you're given the choice between the theory or the doctrine of Buddhism, which is, of course, the Four Noble Truths, or the practice, which do you go for? Do you go, if you had to choose between theory and the practice, which would you go for? Everybody's got it right, actually. Yes, practice. Practice is actually very, very important. The theory is important too, otherwise we may not be practicing in a very effective way. We may not be practicing in the most efficient way to achieve the goal. But practice is the most important thing, because if we practice, we can realize the teachings. And this is the whole point of it, not just to know the theory of the teaching, but actually to practice and realize it for ourselves. Because Buddhism, unlike other religions, is not a faith system. It's not a great, you know, we talk about the great faiths. And in those faiths, you have to have faith in the like Christ or In Islam, we have to have faith in Allah and so on, and in Judaism as well. Faith is very, very important. But in Buddhism, the emphasis is on direct experience. Of course, the Buddha is telling us his experience, but we all have to realize, isn't it, that's his experience, his knowledge, not ours. And we have to make it ours for ourselves. And we can only do that by practice. And one of the criteria the Buddha mentioned for checking whether he was an enlightened being was the third one, apart from, you know, the usual ones. If you see an enlightened, somebody who claims to be an enlightened being, the Buddha said, you can check me out. He said, you know, you can check up on their behaviour, whether they speak or they do things that are obviously coming from negative states of mind, from unwholesome states of mind. That's a very good way to tell if somebody's enlightened or not. Because if they've got anger or a lot of greed, very likely they're not. Well, they're not enlightened for sure. But the third, the last method he mentioned was for checking up if the Buddha was an enlightened being, is to practice what he taught and to see if you reach the same results, if you achieve the same things that the Buddha taught and many other disciples of the Buddha taught. And in English we have this saying, don't we, proof of the pudding. That's the proof of the pudding, really. So he's really not inviting us to believe him. He's not like this car salesman who says, believe me, or when they're selling homes, dodgy homes or dodgy cars. And he's not asking us to believe. He's asking us to find out for ourselves. And in actual fact, that gives us that faith, doesn't it, that confidence to practice. Because immediately somebody asks us to believe in them. I don't know about you, but for me, I sort of, it's sort of an ask, isn't it? It really is quite a big ask. And also, you know, that sort of creates a bit of a block in a way. But when somebody says, please investigate whether my claims are true or not, you sort of, you know, you're much more prepared to listen and try what he's teaching. So this is a very important thing about the Buddha's teaching. And I think when we contemplate the Noble Eightfold Path, things that are very important, that I've thought are very important to me, is what has, for each of us actually, what has brought us here to the centre, you know, why are we here? What has led us to practice a spiritual path, whether it be Buddhism, Christianity or whatever? You know, what is it that drives us? What is the importance of a spiritual teaching? And I think for everyone, myself particularly, people are always asking me, you know, why did you become a monk? You know, like almost like, you know, something that's like a Martian or something. Why did you become a monk? As if it's incredibly extraordinary or, you know. So the reasons I became a monk are probably the very reasons that many of you came here, you know, to a Buddhist centre. And they're not a big mystery, you know. Sometimes the personal details of why people become monks or nuns can be quite amazing, actually, can be. So there are lots of reasons why people practice a spiritual path or come to a spiritual path. And the most common is that they're born as a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim. That is very common. And then, but out of those people who are born into a religion, how many practice? It's not sure, you know, and at what level they practice, that's another thing. So one of the main things that drives most of us actually to find a spiritual teaching, find something, to look, to search for something, a spiritual teaching, is actually our dissatisfaction with our lives. You know, what the unsatisfactory things in our lives, they drive us actually to search. And these things can be, you know, physical, of course. Sometimes they're physical, like we have sickness or old age, or we're facing death. You know, we're all facing death, actually. So it could be one of those things. And the Buddha, actually, he called those deva-dutas. Deva is like divine, and dutta is a messenger. So divine messengers. I don't know how many people think of them as divine messengers, but they certainly wake us up, and they make us ask, you know, how do I deal with this? You know, how do I deal with sickness, old age, and death? And you're not alone. If you think, you know, you're the only one that's asked those questions, you're not alone, because it's why the Buddha actually became the Buddha. Those things propelled him to find a way beyond old age, sickness and death. And he did. He found a way. And that is, of course, attaining Nibbana. So this is a very important thing. And of course, it's not only the physical, and the Buddha was pointing to this when he talks about the first noble truth of suffering or unsatisfactoriness. It's also the mental states we experience. And this drives us very much. For me, it was important too, you know, because we experience, most people will experience sometime in their life, anxiety, depression, fear, jealousy, anger. We see people with rage. All these things are, you know, within our experience. And we realize, it doesn't take an Albert Einstein to realize these are unpleasant and we have to do something about them. So often taking up a spiritual path is very much that, you know, dealing with these unsatisfactory elements of life, you know, whether it be the physical, as I mentioned, or the mental, and to find some sort of peace or resolution with these things, some sort of understanding of them is very important. And hand in hand with that, goes hand in hand with that, is actually our search for happiness. This is actually what drives most human beings, is the search for happiness, looking for that sense of ease and contentment and peace with the world, not only with the world, but with ourselves. You know, finding something amidst the ups and downs of life that is sort of stable, and we can feel a sense of a security and happiness there. And as recently, there was a lovely a book with a lovely title, and some of you may know it, and I really like this one. It's called A Mind at Home with Itself. A Mind at Home with Itself. It's just lovely. It's very nice. And that, in a sense, that's the aim of Buddhism, you know, a mind at home with itself. And this is what we would all like to experience, isn't it? Just to be, the sense of being at home with yourself. Being at home, if you're at home with yourself, very likely, isn't it, you'll be at home with the world, the external situations. If we come from a sense of peace, happiness, contentment within ourselves, then it's very much easier to interact with the world, to deal with it in a wise way, and especially when things don't go the way we wish. So this is very, it's very important. It's what we're really looking for. And I like, I always like Ajahn Chah's, there's a teaching Ajahn Chah gave called Our Real Home, Our Real Home. That's what he used that phrase in the teaching, actually. But that's what we're all searching for, our real home, you know, and that sense of peace and happiness, contentment within, fulfillment within. And of course, this is very much what the Buddha is aiming at, what the teachings are aiming at, that inner sense of ease and peace. And of course, the last thing, and this was very important for me too, it's probably very important for most of us here actually, and it is for any members of any spiritual tradition actually, is meaning in life. We really crave meaning. Meaning is very important for us to know why we're here, you know, because that's a very common question, is why am I here? Why am I here? And of course, this is the meaning of life we're seeking, and it is actually something that we need actually to survive. And I remember, some of you might have read this book actually by Viktor Frankl. Have you read Man's Search for Meaning? Fantastic book, it really is. I haven't read it for years. I'd like to read it again, but this is a story. Well, it's not a story; it's factual. A man's experience in the concentration camps in Germany during the Second World War. And he was Jewish, and he was a psychologist, and survived the experience, actually, so he continued, and he wrote the book. And he was in this concentration camp, and the things that he wrote in that book were amazing, because people, you know, concentration camp must be the most brutal, horrific sort of place to be in, you know, to live in. And so much uncertainty, insecurity, as I said, fear and anxiety must go with it. And I was amazed in that book. You can read for yourself. Some people, it's not all, you know, not lots of people did it. Some people would be able to manage to go within, to leave the external world, which is absolutely horrific, and go within and find joy and peace within, in that setting. Amazing, isn't it? And we have difficulty at home. So if they can do it in a concentration camp, wow. But they're the very few, you know, it's not everybody that can do that. But sometimes you do see that when people are pushed, they're at their limit, they will, you know, go within and then get to this deep source of peace that's inside. This deep inner sense of security too and well-being that is just unbelievable considering the circumstances they're in, a concentration camp. So this is possible. And that was not the point of mentioning Viktor Frankl though, but there's another story in there that he mentions of a man who had this idea that the Second World War would end on, I think it was in March 1945, he thought it would end. He had this dream, and in that, it ended on this exact day. And so he was, you know, he was really quite happy. It gave him a sense of purpose, and he was looking forward to it and ready for it. And it's absolutely certain. And then the day came, the war didn't end. The next day came, and then it went on. And then he became depressed with it, despairing about it. And then eventually he died. Because, this is what Viktor Frankl says, he says he'd lost his meaning. But in the same way, we all need meaning and purpose in our lives. If we don't have purpose in our lives, they seem meaningless. And Viktor Frankl has a very nice saying in that book, I think it's in that book, he says that suffering, this is a very Buddhist term, without meaning equals despair. Suffering without meaning equals despair. You could say depression. This is what we're experiencing in modern society, isn't it? In a very large degree, is people have this sense of there's no purpose in life, there's no meaning. It's sort of random, and they feel like they're getting a poor deal out of it. And so then it hasn't got a meaning for them. It hasn't got a meaning. So therefore, They are very prone, as naturally you would be, you know, to depression and despair. That's very common. And I think we see it, particularly I see it with young people committing suicide. I know it's a big phenomenon throughout the world. I see it in Sri Lanka. Just before I left Sri Lanka, just over a week ago, a woman came to me and told me about her 18-year-old son who'd committed suicide 3 months before. Only son. It was amazing, you know, and I've heard a few other suicides in Sri Lanka, you know, of young men, young boys, committing suicide. And the sense of despair, or one would imagine despair, has driven them to it. And of course the parents always feel, why did they do it? That's very hard for them, actually. So this is a very important reason why we, you know, search for a spiritual teaching, search for a path. And is meaning, and its meaning is very important to us. So I think, so it's good for us also to reflect, you know, whatever spiritual tradition we are involved with, to think that, to remember what brought us to Buddhism, what brought us to whatever religion we are involved with. What were the motivating factors? Because it's good to remember those, bring them up and renew them. Because then we can check. These have been like aims or goals that we've been searching for. So we can check, are we realizing those aims or goals? Is it what we thought it would be? And the Buddha gave a very lovely way to check up if we are making progress, because this is what basically everybody wants to do, is make progress in their path, whatever path they're practicing, and particularly make progress towards happiness. And the Buddha said, very simple, if you can see that wholesome states are increasing, you know, these are the positive states in mind, and the negative states are decreasing, then you're making progress. Because very often for us, isn't it, it's gradual. Gradual. And the Buddha had a very nice simile of that. He said, it's like a tool that has a handle and you use the tool often, but it's only after a long time you see that the handle, maybe it's wooden, is wearing away and you see the wear. And in the same way, it's often very slow for us to see the progress. And often, you know, we don't check up We don't check up, and it's good to check up, see what we were interested in developing when we undertook this path. And it actually renews or revitalizes our energy, gives us more energy, actually. And maybe, you know, hopefully, we also get some happiness out of it because we think, well, I have changed, you know. This is, oh, yeah, I'm not as angry as I used to be, you know. I'm not as jealous. I'm not, you know, as greedy as I used to be. It's reduced some of these negative qualities. And that gives us even more incentive to practice. Unfortunately, because life for most people is fairly fast and furious, we say, fast and furious, they don't have time to check up. But it's good to do that, just to do a review on how we're going. You know, are we realizing the aims that we had in mind when we undertook this path? So this is something that's very useful. And it's good too, this is important with the Noble Eightfold Path, to remember that the Noble Eightfold Path, like many spiritual teachings, is a whole. It fits together. It has a purpose. Everything in it has a purpose. And we have a tendency, I was reading Bhikkhu Bodhi last night, and he was talking about this tendency. We have a tendency in modern day life to just pick and choose bits and pieces that we like from different traditions. So, you know, and you know, you might be doing some Sufi dancing and some Buddhist meditation and, you know, something else. You know, you could be doing a whole range of practices. And he makes the point, and I think it's very valid, that especially with the Noble Eightfold Path, it is a complete whole practice. And it's good if we can take that whole practice on board. And admittedly, we may practice it in a different order from other people, but that doesn't matter. So I think probably the next thing to address is what is the Noble Eightfold Path? I think everybody here knows, but nevertheless. I like to use the Buddha's words because it's coming straight from the Buddha, and that's the best. The Noble Eightfold Path, of course, is the first teaching that the Buddha gave. It's in the first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And this is the turning of the wheel of Dhamma. And that actually is a very useful symbol. I was going to mention that it actually symbolises, if you've seen, I don't know if you've got one here, symbolises the Noble Eightfold Path, because it's a wheel and it's got eight spokes, and so there are eight factors in the Noble Eightfold Path, and they all meet in the centre. And this is like the Noble Eightfold Path, that it is a complete entity. If you took the spokes out of a wheel, this spoke out, that spoke out, eventually the wheel wouldn't work at all. And this is the message, part of the message of the Dhammacakka, you know, the wheel of Dhamma, that these eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path are important, and none of them we can do without. None of them we can do without. So, and they all, of course, the hub is sort of like the where it's leading to, you could say. It's leading to liberation. They all lead to, they all support liberation. And that liberation is the liberation of the mind from all suffering. And that's the goal of the Buddha's teaching, and is what most people are looking for in one form or another, though sometimes people, they are looking for happiness in the wrong places, and that's fairly obvious. So the Dhammacakka is the first teaching that the Buddha gave, and of course it's about the Four Noble Truths. You might have heard of the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Truth of, we say, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, the origin of that suffering or unsatisfactoriness, and the cessation of that suffering or unsatisfactoriness, and the way leading to that cessation of unsatisfactoriness or suffering. And of course, the way leading to it is the practice part, isn't it? And this is the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's such a neat teaching. This gives you an idea of, you know, how comprehensive and how integrated it all is, that the Four Noble Truths includes the Noble Eightfold Path we're talking about, I'm talking about today. And the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is we call right view or right understanding. Sometimes people call it right understanding, quite nice actually. And part of that, part of right view, is understanding the Four Noble Truths. So it dovetails. I say dovetails. It ties in together very, very well. That the Four Noble Truths includes the Noble Eightfold Path, and the Noble Eightfold Path includes the Four Noble Truths. So it all ties together very well. And this is what you see with the Buddha's teaching, actually. More and more I see it. You know, everything has a purpose and fits together, and you can use it and develop it, and it will support your practice. And this is essential, really, to the path. So let's just, I'll read the Buddha's words, and not my own, so then you're getting it straight from the text. There are these two extremes that should be avoided: the pursuit of happiness through the five senses. This is Ajahn Brahm's translation, if you're wondering where this comes from. Yes, it's good, though, I think. Which is low, and this is hina, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial. And the second one is the pursuit of practices that fatigue the body and mind. This is often called self-mortification. Doesn't mean much in English, actually, that word. And he said, and the Buddha continues, which is painful, and certainly is, ignoble and unbeneficial. Without going to either of these extremes, the Buddha has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to wisdom, which leads to peace, which leads to direct understanding, to enlightenment, and to nibbana. It is this Noble Eightfold Path, which is the middle way, right view or right understanding, right motivation, often called right intention or right thought in other translations, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right endeavour or right effort, samavayama, right mindfulness, and right stillness. Or people are very used to concentration, right concentration, but it's Ajahn Brahm, and I agree, it gives the wrong feeling for meditation as being strong effort and using force. And the Buddha concludes in this section anyway, this is only a quote from the actual teaching, this is that middle way awakened to by the Buddha, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to wisdom, which gives rise to peace, gives rise to direct understanding, to enlightenment, to nibbana. So this is giving the context of the Noble Eightfold Path, all these eight factors that we need to develop in order to realize the ending of suffering. And none of them, as I say, can we do without. Sometimes people try. They try to do without some factor or another, you know. So, but in actual fact, when you, Ajahn Chah often said too, that for Westerners, he noticed, Ajahn Chah was a meditation master in northeast Thailand, and he passed away in the 91 he passed away, and he noticed, he had a very great rapport with Westerners actually, with foreigners, and taught a lot. And he noticed that they, most of the Westerners who became monks under him, they started with meditation, and then they would develop sila, then perhaps dana would come after that. So he said, no matter, it's all connected. It's all connected. One supports the other. But the usual way of developing the path, of course, is dana. Dana is giving, generosity. And then sila, ethical behaviour, or body and speech. And then bhavana, mental cultivation, is the usual way. In a traditional Buddhist society, that's how you would teach it. But he said in the West, because he also travelled to Britain and America and taught there, so he saw firsthand how people practice. But of course, if you develop the mind, if you develop meditation, you develop some mindfulness, stillness, you're going to see, aren't you? Very, very quickly you see, well, my behaviour is important, you know, of body and speech, that's important. And also you see, you need these positive mind states actually to support the development of meditation, because they are the springboard actually for going deeper. If we're unhappy, it's very unlikely the meditation will come together. So these are very important things we see. So we see it all interconnecting. So these factors, I'll just run over them briefly, actually mention them briefly, and then start with, first of all, right view or right understanding is very important, actually. Sometimes people say, well, why is it the first factor? Because, you know, if you have to develop sila, usually they develop sila first and then meditation, bhavana, and then wisdom. There's another way of looking at it. So why is it the first factor in the Noble Eightfold Path? And one of the very good reasons for it being the first factor, it's also the last factor too, because as we grow and our understanding really matures, then that side of right view wisdom really comes together, and we have, you know, we have a real understanding that leads to breakthrough, actually. Then, so the reason we need it at the beginning, isn't it, is that it gives us the incentive to practice. Actually, if we have a right view, if we have an idea that the Buddha's teaching can help us, it can lead to us being more at peace with ourselves. We can understand the difficulties in our lives, the dissatisfaction or the unsatisfactory elements of our life. Then this is going to propel us to practice the Buddha's path. And so it is a very important stepping stone, the beginning, actually, of the practice. And this is where we have to have some idea that maybe this teaching will be of benefit to me. Maybe it addresses what I need to know. And the big issues that we all need to know, aren't they? Are this unsatisfactoriness, for sure, the sufferings in our lives. And also the other thing is the fact that everything is very temporary. We see things changing around us. We see that nothing is stable, permanent, which many people would like. Permanency. And also, most of us experience, this is the big troublemaker in life, this feeling of self. What to do about this feeling of self? You know, how do we come to terms with it? How do we come to peace with it and deal with it, inquire into it? So this teaching of the Buddha, this right view or right understanding, is focusing on these areas. Principally, first of all, through the Four Noble Truths, of course, they're there, and they're the main focus of right view, and it encompasses nearly everything else. But it also includes in right view the sense that there is a result from giving. This is a very important dana, we say, the word dana, generosity. It is a point. It does have a significance. And in relation to that, that there is karma, that what we do, positively or negatively, creates a result from that. There will be effects that arise from that, either in accordance to the original action. Whether it, if it's a negative action, then a negative result will follow. And if it's a positive one, then a positive result or reaction will follow. So this is very important too. And then the other thing that's very important, and these things... And rebirth is very important, the idea that we have more than one life. And also the other essential thing of right view is that there are enlightened beings, and in this case principally, that the Buddha was enlightened. Having said those things, you know, having said that right view is, you know, the Four Noble Truths, and it's especially karma, rebirth, and believing in enlightened beings, we don't have to take that on board 100%. We are there. We can inquire into it. And people, even in Sri Lanka, actually, they ask me, you know, do you have to believe in karma and rebirth to be a Buddhist? And the answer, of course, is no. No, you don't. You know, you just have... The only requirement, actually, to become a Buddhist is really taking the three refuges and... just the three refuges, actually. You know, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. And that's the qualification for becoming a Buddhist. Becoming a practicing Buddhist, of course, five precepts. But that's not asked, even at that stage. So this is very much the right view shouldn't be seen as, you know, like some people might think of it, you have to believe in this. If you don't believe in it, forget about it. The Buddha's not saying that, because, of course, the whole of the Buddha's path is about investigation, knowing for ourselves, understanding for ourselves. And this is what we do with right view, gradually, gradually. You know, many people when they come to Buddhism, they find, say, not karma, not so difficult. Because if you come from a Christian background, isn't it, you tend to think, you know, as you sow, so shall you reap, which is what Jesus said. And so people in a more Christian-oriented society, they're used to that idea of karma, so that's not so difficult to take on board. But rebirth is more, many people find that more difficult. Though these days that's changing too, isn't it? I hear a lot of people believe in rebirth, and there's a lot of scientific evidence for it. So it's quite now it's becoming more acceptable. So now the second factor of the noble act, it's very important with any undertaking in life, isn't it? We have a clear idea of what our aims are, our view of what we want to achieve, where we're going. And this is what right view is about. We're clear from where we're coming from, it in a sense it propels us in a particular direction towards liberation, actually, or greater happiness in this life. Yes. So the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, everybody probably knows it, Sammasankappa. That's often translated as right intention, right thought. But I like Ajahn Brahm's translation of right motivation. It's really good. Right motivation. It's different, so it makes you think, you know. But it's where we're coming from, and this is actually vital for how we practice, isn't it? Because it's all very well to have a goal, a name, a clear idea of what the purpose of a path is, you know. But how the quality of how we travel that path is also essential. Do we travel it with a lot of positive mind states or a lot of negative mind states? You know, and this is very important. For us, and sometimes people forget this, you know, Sammasankappa. Of course, those that have heard Ajahn Brahm teach are reminded all the time, so it's very good. But so this is letting go is one of the first qualities of right motivation. So letting go of unwholesome things in our life, letting go of of greed, of the anger in our life, and also to letting go of delusion if we can. Biggest delusion for all of us is really the sense of self, which causes a lot of suffering. If people don't think that, just check up in your life, you know, what causes you a lot of suffering. If people, abuse you or whatever, you very quickly see, if they blame you, criticize you, this sense of self comes up really strongly, and it's good to investigate. What's this all about, you know? So this is a very very important area for us to, as it were, let go, have patience, develop patience. And the other quality that the of right motivation, isn't it, is non-anger or non-ill will, they sometimes say. And this, in a more positive way, is loving kindness. It includes much more, of course. When you say non-ill will, it can include, you know, qualities like patience, kanti, that being able to bear with difficult situations without having a negative mind state. Sometimes people can, you know, they can bear with things, but they're gritting their teeth and they're very angry inside. No good for them, actually. So, but loving kindness is a very the most important expression of non ill will. And then non-harming, this is motivation that drives us to hurt others, either by speech or ourselves, it's ourselves too, by speech or by action. You know, we can say some terrible things to people that really put them in their place. And that's not good. We feel it later, actually, we feel it. So these right motivation, very important for how we practice the path. Because if we practice the path with a lot of wanting to get things, whether it be spiritual attainments or other things, it's usually spiritual attainments if you're practicing a spiritual path, or if we have a real sense of going out there and doing it very forcefully, that won't help much either. That's not a good motivation. You know, of course, energy is important. It is important, but if it's a sort of this negative, you know, sort of macho type approach. This is not good. And of course, harming ourselves or others, you know, is obviously not good, not good. So those two, the sense of where we're going and how we travel that path, very important. They're the most important. And then after that, we have right speech. And that is a very big area in society. Right speech always refers to, of course, firstly, lying, you know, not lying. This is what we're restraining ourselves from in the five precepts. And also from sometimes called divisive speech, you know, telling tales to other people about other people, so that the person we tell the tale to feels divided from, feels negative towards the person that we're talking about. So this is a quality that doesn't lead to harmony, doesn't lead to our happiness either, for that matter. And then after that, of course, there is harsh speech, and this is sometimes very evident on YouTube and the internet and in general, and Australian society in particular. You know, harsh speech is, you know, rough speech, it's swearing and all those sorts of things. Abusive speech, isn't it? You know, abusive, not only swearing, because sometimes people can speak very harshly and it's not, they're not using any four-letter words or whatever, but they're very common. So, and then the last type of right speech, of course, is avoiding gossip and idle chatter, they call it, because this just distracts the mind. It's entertaining in a sense, and most of the internet built on it. Actually, I think all this news that we see, you know, and gossip about various celebrities and what they're doing and whatnot. Yes. And so that's a very important part of our lives. And of course, right action is the five precepts, but without the fifth precept, of course. It's not intentionally harming living beings. It's not taking what's not given. That's stealing, isn't it? And it's not sexual misconduct, which we see happening a lot these days in the news. Hear a lot of news about it. And it's not those three, actually, because we've got lying already, actually. And it's not including avoiding taking alcohol or other intoxicants. It doesn't include that for some reason. That's in the five precepts. So that's right action. That's very important. And then right livelihood. There are livelihoods that don't harm ourselves, you know, in terms of bad karma, you know, making negative karma, and don't harm others. So amongst those trades that the Buddha mentioned for lay people, he also mentioned some for monks too, but not the same five, are things like being involved in the meat industry, you know, which requires killing animals and so on, and industries that are based on, or activities that are based on alcohol, drugs, those sorts of things. On people, things that exploit people. So this is, you know, like people traffickers these days are making a lot of money out of people's misery. And also, you know, exploiting, say, in prostitution and things like that. So these are some of the wrong livelihoods that the Buddha pointed to. And they're very obvious, isn't it, why you would think these are not good things, actually, not good things. And after right livelihood, of course, is right action, or Ajahn Brahm's now calling it right endeavour. And this is central to the how we practice the whole path as well, because right effort is aiming at four things, and they interlock very well. First of all, to avoid negative states of mind, if possible. So we know ourselves, and we know what things bring up negative states of mind, and we avoid those if we can. And the second thing is, if a negative state happens to arise, which can happens quite frequently, then we abandon it, we let go of it. And then the other side of the coin is, if we develop positive states of mind that we don't have at the moment, that are not in our experience, in our mind at the moment, and then we maintain those positive states of mind. And you can see the two, they fit together, because if you develop positive states of mind, you're avoiding negative states of mind, and you don't need to abandon, actually. And if you maintain them, of course, then there's very little scope for these negative qualities to come up in the mind. So this right effort is really pointing to the fact that we're monitoring our experience all the time, and and you know, sort of seeing what qualities are in the mind. And we need to develop, of course, an X factor mindfulness, which everybody has probably knows a lot about. So mindfulness, being in the present moment, knowing what's happening in this present moment, and letting go of the past and the future. But also mindfulness has the sense of memory as well, memory, that we remember things from a long time ago. So Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's personal assistant, you might say, was the foremost in sati, in mindfulness, because he could remember incredible amount of the Buddha's teachings. In fact, most of the Buddha's teachings that we have are due to him, his memory, fantastic memory. It was incredible. And mindfulness is very important, of course, for all the other factors too. They support each other. If you're not mindful, how can you keep right speech? How can you keep right action? And so on, you know, and develop the other factors of the path. So all of this feeds in. And of course, the last one that I was going to mention is right stillness, or often known as concentration here in a lot of the books. And that is very important too. That develops actually, in a sense, from sati. And this is called samadhi in the Pali terms. And it's always, the Buddha is always teaching it as the four jhanas, which are the deep states of meditation, very deep states of stillness, which give rise to a very powerful mind, very penetrative mind, that can see things as they really are. In fact, the Buddha said that the condition, the cause for samadhi, for this stillness to arise, is happiness. Then there's the stillness, this really one-pointedness of mind, where it's a lot of bliss, happiness. And then from that, this powerful, still mind, then insight can arise, seeing things as they are, yata bhuta, jnana dasana. So this is very important, important thing to develop. Whether we can develop the jhanas or not, we need some stillness of mind, some degree of stillness of mind. And Ajahn Chah, when asked how much samadhi do we need, how much stillness, how much concentration, he said, enough, enough. I think, wow. But of course, that's as it is, you know, that's the way life is, because you know, if you develop stillness of mind, there will come some insights. And the more stillness, the bigger the insights, actually. So I'd just like to finish off by, first of all, saying that the purpose of the Noble Eightfold Path is threefold. And that is happiness here and now, because it actually makes it possible for us to avoid creating negative karma, which we can experience in this life, and develop positive karma. So happiness in this life, happiness in future lives, if people believe in future lives. And then the third thing is that one can experience nirvana, the highest happiness, the finishing with all delusion, with all unsatisfactoriness, the end of all that. So that's the aims of the Buddha's teaching. And I'd like to conclude with an encouraging comment from the Buddha. And this is again Ajahn Brahm's translation. I like it. It's quite good. Listen, it says, listen, the end of dying has been reached. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma. Practicing as you are instructed, by realizing for yourself in this very life through direct understanding, you will soon enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which people rightly go forth into monastic life. So that's it. That's good. So it's an encouragement for us to know that if we practice, we'll get the results ourselves. And they will be good results, actually. Happiness in this life, in future lives, or even attaining nirvana.